You're listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode 113 for the week of January 19th, 2011.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Scott Juster.
I'm George Albor.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a website we created and dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games. And we are still working through our backlog of 2010 stuff.
We are, yeah. We're getting there.
I wanted to leave it all in 2010. Just leave it in 2010.
Well, hopefully we'll try to... We'll crunch up 2011 in like a couple months, and then we'll move on to 2012 by March.
And then after 2012, we won't have to worry about anything because the Mayan apocalypse will have happened.
That's exactly right.
But before that does happen, we should go through some of the pieces of writing from 2010 that we enjoyed regarding video games.
Yeah, and we should say, you know, no one really does the games writing roundup better than Critical Distance.
Mm-hmm.
Started by Ben Abraham, and it collects all of the greatest gamers' writings on the net, or at least a wide variety of them, and puts them in one place. We're not going to be formulating it in their style necessarily, but I just wanted to mention it before we start, because if you're ever curious about where we get some of our posts to talk about on the podcast, or if you want to find some good writing of your own to read through, Critical Distance is the site to go to.
Yeah, they cast an increasingly wide net, and I'm just surprised at how much stuff there is out there. I mean, we can't, you know, no one human can possibly read it all, so it's nice to, you know, just go over a few pieces of writing that we liked, because things get lost in the shuffle. And I mean, there's some things where I mean to, like, you know, write comments or write about them, and, you know, the weeks kind of just drag on and new games come out and things get lost.
Yeah, I've started to just skimming articles, and then if they look like they're particularly interesting, I put them in a folder to read later, and that folder is gigantic.
Yeah. Well, let's make a small dent in it this week. You want to start off with one article that you enjoyed from last year?
Sure. And so my first article is somewhat cheating because it's more than just this one article. It's also the entire conversation that felt like everyone was going back to in 2010, and it spawned dozens of posts easily. And this article is called OK Kids, Playing My Lawn. It's by Roger Ebert from the Chicago Sun-Times. So if you know what I'm talking about here, this is the discussion that Roger Ebert had pertaining to video games. And if you've been living under a rock and you don't know, Roger Ebert essentially said a while ago that video games cannot be a high form of art. And of course, gamers all around the world came out from their bedrooms and their rocks, away from their computers and, you know, down from the mountaintops to tell Roger Ebert that no, he is factually incorrect. There's Shadow of the Colossus, and I wept when playing Mario Galaxy, and, you know, there's Heavy Rain, and there's all these amazing things that he just doesn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
They are, of course, right. Video games are art, and that's that. But Roger Ebert's post sparked a lot of interesting conversations. And in particular, his article, OK Kids Playing My Lawn, is really him, you know, maybe he's too sure of himself to write out a full apology. But yeah. I think that Play on My Lawn is as close as we're ever going to get. And in this article, Roger Ebert mentions that, yeah, he'd never played a lot of games. When given the opportunity to play games, he passed them up. And he probably should not have been talking out of his ass.
That's a direct quote.
Yeah, I mean, basically, hold on, let me bring up the article real quick. Roger Ebert says specifically, I should not have written that entry, referring to the previous entry about video games not being art, without being more familiar with the actual experience of playing video games. But he says he knows why that is the case, why he has no desire to play whatsoever. And he says, one, I had no desire to spend 20 to 40 hours playing a video game, whether I admired it or not, whether I was in a lose-lose position, and he was just too bullheaded. So
yeah.
One of the reasons...
It's really rough, because one of the things that started off this... Well, I mean, it's an ongoing conversation with him, but one of the things that started off the more recent round was a response that he wrote to Kelly Santiago's TED Talk.
That's right.
which is a shame because, you know, she her latest game was Flower, and it would not have taken him 20 to 40 hours to play that.
Yeah.
And it is a lot more similar to traditional art that he's familiar with. I mean, if you're going to get something that doesn't have a win-loss state, and it, you know, it doesn't have points, it doesn't have any kind of over-the-top participatory violence or anything, I mean, this is as close as he's going to get to a Renaissance painting or whatever he thinks art is. It's just a shame that he didn't even play the game of the person that he was engaging with, you know, after he watched that video.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Roger Ebert's a film critic, and he never espouses to be anything but. His blog is fantastic, and I think he's an absolutely amazing writer.
Yeah, it's entertaining. Yeah, entertaining to read.
It's kind of a shame that he doesn't venture into the video game medium, because I think that there's so much to learn there. That being said, one of the reasons I chose this post is because, in my opinion, it marks the not the death of this argument, but kind of the collective moving past this fear that games are not art. Because quite a few writers responded that, yes, you're wrong. You know, he doesn't define art. He doesn't do a lot of things in his series of posts about video games. But more importantly, these questions aren't even necessary. We don't even have to be having this conversation with Roger Ebert, because he's admitting that this is not his specialty. You know, he's a film critic. Leave the games criticism to games critics or what have you.
Yeah, which is why it's kind of funny that we're talking about it now, but I don't even think I said one word. Maybe I said one or two tweets, but they were all about, like, this is classic trolling, everybody. he is a master internet troll. Like, he's saying a couple things and just getting the ire of everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, see, he seemed to have a pretty good laugh about it. So it's just kind of like, don't engage this shit. 'Cause I mean, you're just, you know, you're right. You know, he doesn't know anything about games. So why are you looking for that kind of approval?
Yeah. And I recall when this article first came out, you and I had a conversation about whether or not we felt like we had some obligation to talk about his post on the podcast. Yeah. And we both agreed that, you know, yeah, he's trolling. You know, he's not a critic, and we would be giving the statement that video games are not art too much credence if we were to talk about it in any serious capacity. Yeah. So this is kind of my way to go.
And he's gotten the last laugh. Oh, damn you, Ebert.
Yeah. Well, how about you? What have you got from 2010?
Okay, I'll start off my first one with, we actually mentioned this article recently because we've been talking about Bioshock 2. This is Justin Cavern's massive project that he's undertaking, continuing project, I believe. It's called Groping the Map.
Yes.
And you know, the one that I read most carefully was the one about Bioshock 2, in which he takes a specific level of a game and just dissects it and takes meticulous screenshots and goes by basically step by step of how the level's put together, when the events take place, why certain things are even colored in certain shades.
Yeah.
It's just a really exhaustive analysis of various levels from famous games.
Yeah, it was really great going back to the Bioshock 2 one after we talked about it and after I'd played it, because I was rereading it, and it was kind of revealing what was going through my head while playing without even realizing that was going through my head while playing it. You know?
Yeah.
And especially Bioshock 2, where, you know, two weeks ago we were talking about how well the level design of Bioshock 2 is constructed, and how, to some extent, how much better it is than the first Bioshock, especially in the scenes where you have to harvest the atom from the little sisters. And Justin does a great job of going through all of the locations that you're kind of faced with and sort of comprehending them in that way. And I'm mixed, where I partially wish I could do that while playing, you know, and recognizing it. And at the same time, so much of that fiction is removed to talk about the actual structure of those levels that I wonder if it would be distracting, you know?
I mean, I shuddered to think at the number of times he played through all of those levels. Yeah. You know, I mean, he could probably do it blindfolded by now, because there's just so much description there. And, you know, it's something where you really have to sit down and give it a few minutes to read through, because it's comprehensive. But it's the kind of stuff that I like, because, you know, it takes a little bit of time, but it's rewarding once you dig into it.
Yeah, and I don't think I've seen very many other games writers take the same sort of exhaustive approach to it. And I think it's fantastic. It's such a great contribution.
Yeah, I mean, the other the other kind of genre that it exists in, or that I've been exposed to, it is there's a group of people out there that are really into hardcore Super Mario Brothers analysis.
Really?
Like, yeah, like, you know, block counting, like how tall things are, how things are shaped, how things are, like, just really minute details. But that's a whole another rabbit hole.
Yeah, and that's such a very specific game. And Justin goes on to do Thief, which I never actually read because I haven't played Thief yet. And again, I'm worried about the mechanical spoilers involved, so.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I hope he keeps on doing that, and especially, you know, jumps back and forth between new and old games, because I think it's neat to contrast, you know, what changes have been taking place, and if there's certain types of design decisions that have fallen out of favor or maybe have persisted over the years. Like, this kind of rigorous analysis reveals that stuff.
When Justin first was creating the series of posts, he asked people for ideas. Were there any games that you would have been particularly interested in seeing an exhaustive approach to level design analysis?
I would like to see a Mirror's Edge one, especially since I know he personally is really into Mirror's Edge. You know, I've read his older stuff about
pandering
it.
To the writer, huh?
Well, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, give him a couple ideas. Maybe he can give me some reading material soon enough. Yeah, I know you're listening to this, Justin. okay, well, how about your next article?
Sure, so my next article is by Tom Bissell.
He had a big year last year,
He did, yeah. He released Extra Lives, which I own. It's sitting on my shelf right now, and I've only read like 10 pages of it. But I'm looking very much forward to it. Tom Bissell is an excellent writer. And this piece is called Video Games, The Addiction, and it was originally posted in The Guardian UK. And it's kind of cheating also, because it's not really about... I mean, yes, it's...
Oh, I did read this. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
it is about video games, but it's not about analyzing Grand Theft Auto, even though it is about Grand Theft Auto. It's a much more personal story about Tom's personal life, his arc as a games writer, and then kind of falling out of that. He got into a heavy cocaine addiction and tried to wrestle with that over several periods in his life, doing a lot of traveling. And one of the things that went with him this entire time was Grand Theft Auto. And so this entire post is... It's strange because it's very intimate, and it's not something that I'm used to when reading about... it's not something I'm used to when reading games journalism. It's very much a personal account of his experiences with Grand Theft Auto. And it's not something that you know, you or I will experience in the same way. But that's one of the reasons I think it's such a valuable piece, is because it takes something that we all play and... has some aspect of it that's universal, right? He talks about Grand Theft Auto almost as a fuel for his cocaine addiction, or an addiction in and of itself. There's so much talk about games as forms of addiction, and how games can't be addictive. And although this post, you know, I don't think it's agreeing with some of those Fox News pundits who warn about video games. Yeah. It is saying that games are incredibly powerful, and they can fill so many different roles in our lives and so many niches, and that includes, you know, when we're having a good time and when we're down in the dumps and, you know, have drug problems or family problems.
That's what I thought the what you pointed out, like, it's a pretty brave piece, because he's buying in. One, he's revealing that stuff about himself, which is pretty heavy stuff. And two, he is dancing really close to that group of people that are like, video games are sinful addictions. And he's basically saying, you know, cocaine and Grand Theft Auto 4 are basically in the same portion of my life. You know, I think of the same things. When I think of one, I think of the other. And it's pretty, I think it's pretty ballsy
absolutely. I'm just going to read a bit from the last paragraph, because I think it illustrates another point of his that's really good. And this is him contemplating the main character of Grand Theft Auto 4. He says, "Nico was not my friend, but I felt for him deeply. He was clearly having a hard go of it and did not always understand why. He was in a new place that did not make a lot of sense. He was trying, he was doing his best, but he was falling into habits and ways of being that did not reflect his best self."
That sounds like someone who's having problems.
And it's cool because I don't know if this is something that Tom was thinking about. In fact, based upon the article, it's certainly not something he was thinking about when playing Grand Theft Auto, but it's something that if we think back to older games, we can find meaning from them and meaning from the games that reflect kind of who we are and what we're struggling with. And one of the reasons we might like a game might because there could be some underlying aspects to that, you know. In some ways, the Grand Theft Auto 4 he's describing is kind of like a deck of tarot cards, you know, where when you're showing to people, you know, it's not, okay, maybe if you believe in it, it's not, but personally, it's not real mysticism. Nothing is magical about tarot cards or palm readings, other than the fact that they draw comparisons that then you are forced to understand in your own life. You know, if you draw the Joker card, you're going to try to understand and look for those aspects of your life that are captured by that analogy. And video games can be the same way if we want to look at them that way.
It's one of those pieces that I guess maybe a couple years ago we would have called new games journalism. I guess that that phrase has kind of fallen out of favor as of late. But yeah, it's this more personal, less, I don't know even how to put it. It's probably, you know, emotionally driven. You know, it's like how people imagine a certain song or a certain band means a thing in their life at a specific time.
Yeah, it's very
time.
Subjective, but it's far more intimate than what we normally think of as subjective games writing.
Yeah, good. That's a perfect way of putting it.
What have you got?
Well, the next, well, it's cheating again. It's a couple articles. So I never got to play Bayonetta last year, which was too bad.
Well, there's always 2011.
I mean, that's one of the games I have, you know, on high priority because so many people wrote about it and it caused so many waves when it came out. And there was two articles that I liked the most about it, and they both came out at the end of the year. And I don't think that's a coincidence because I think a game like that takes a lot of time to really think through. You know, you can stop playing it early, which is, you know, one of the criticisms that, or not necessarily a criticism, but it's one of the things that people fell into, you know, once they get turned off by it, because it's, you know, crazy.
Oh, yeah, there's like hair weapons and like high heel guns.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's naked half the time. When she's not naked, she's blaspheming the other half of the time. There's just, you know, off the wall iconography.
And I haven't even played the game, and I talk to people about it, and people just they laugh and they look like they're in shock, and I think they immediately judge the game as completely worthless, because that was my response, my first response to just the imagery of Bayonetta.
I mean, it's just one of those games where I feel like it really, the people who made it really love the absurdity of video games, and are not trying to have that like Heavy Rain type experience. They're trying to go in the exact opposite direction. They waded into this huge minefield of gender politics and gender identity around it. And the two authors that I wanted to highlight were Tanner Higgin and Amanda Phillips. Tanner Higgin wrote, the title of the post that I read was Making Men Uncomfortable, What Bayonetta Should Learn from Gaga. And so he had this thing where he took a look at Lady Gaga videos and interviews and constructed this argument where Lady Gaga's thing to, you know, her feminism is meant to make patriarchal institutions uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So, you know, she is out there saying outrageous things and kind of cultivating a mystique around her that makes it hard for people that are really invested in hard gender roles to deal with.
Yeah, Gaga is a fascinating persona.
And so he started off his post with that and then went into where Bayonetta didn't go as far as Gaga did.
No meat dresses, is that what you're saying?
I mean, it was really neat because he was talking about, I mean, his idea was that, you know, there is like resistance to traditional gender roles in Bayonetta, but they don't really go after the institutions that, you know, that have created those gender roles. Like, it's all draped in hypersexuality that isn't necessarily made to make anyone feel uncomfortable. Like, she still dances around like a stripper. She still has enormous boobs. You know, she's still doing, you know, she still has suggestive winks at the camera all the time.
Yeah, I don't recall seeing any religious iconography that she combats, but maybe there's some of that. I don't know.
Well, the whole thing is religious iconography. I mean, that's like true, she yeah. battles angels, like, you know, they come down from the heaven and she like puts them in Iron Maidens and stuff like that. I mean, it's all religious stuff.
I wonder what the Pope would think about Bayonetta.
Well, that's one of Amanda Phillips's points. You know, whereas as Tanner didn't think she went far enough. I mean, it was, you know, she doesn't toy with gender itself. She just toys with how far you can go and still be considered feminist.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, something like David Bowie is messing around with gender roles. You know, is he a man? Is he a woman? Is there something in between? You know, Bayonetta is just trying to push the envelope as far as what is considered feminine and what is considered, you know, stereotypical versus subversive.
Yeah.
Whereas Amanda Phillips went into the game and brought out a bunch of examples where the erotic poses that Bayonetta strikes coincide with her like decapitating phallic-like monsters. You know, she at every turn she's smashing institutions of the church, which is a historical oppressor of women. You know, the witch hunt tortures that she uses against her enemies are the kinds of tortures that would have been used against her as a witch, which is wow. also related to her femininity. And so, and you know, maybe she is a more shocking character. I mean, at every instance of her sexuality, you know, while it might look like she's a stripper and maybe might look like it's for the male gaze, behind her there's kind of like a bloody stumped off faux penis. So it's like, are you really supposed to be turned on by that, or are you supposed to be threatened yeah. by that?
And it's almost like the male gaze then is should turn away, or at least they're trying to make that male gaze kind of avert.
Yeah. yeah, exactly. And that's her, you know, the title of her article was Castrating the Straight Male Gaze on Bayonetta, or at least making room for other ones. And it was a really neat response, because Tanner and Amanda had been talking about this together and they had disagreed on it. And, you know, as an added bonus, this was a really nice, productive, cordial, yet substantial disagreement that two people were having, but they clearly enjoyed each other's company nice. A lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just nice to have like disagreements without flame wars, basically.
You have sold me on this game now. It'll quickly climb my backlog.
One of the things that Amanda says at the end of her article is that I think Bayonetta might have been an accident.
Interesting.
That they might not have meant for all this stuff to slip in, and you know, we'll see when the inevitable Bayonetta sequel comes out what they do with it.
Yeah. Is it inevitable, a sequel?
I think it did pretty well. I mean, it was on a lot of people's best of and best of the rest type lists, and Platinum's on a roll, you know. I mean, they are doing well with Vanquish and they did well with Bayonetta. So I mean, hopefully I would like to see what they do with it, even if it doesn't turn out right. It'll be nice to analyze why they changed
yeah,
it.
Interesting.
yeah.
Okay, well, I'll wrap up my collection of articles with sort of another cheat, but this is an article called The Presence of the Past in Fallout 3, and it's by Trevor Owens from Play the Past. This is mm-hmm. actually a relatively recent article, and it talks about Fallout 3 as a historical journey. Something that you play while slowly piecing together the reality of what you're going through. And while I think this article is great, really the reason I selected it is because I wanted to draw attention to Play the Past itself. And this is a mm-hmm. website that chooses to look at video games as a form of cultural heritage that expresses and functions within a discourse of history and how we understand history and how we relate to history and how we play through games, sometimes with a historical lens, sometimes without a historical lens. And I think it's an awesome approach, and it's something that I'm so glad is around. They've had mm-hmm. some recent ones about Michael Hofstadter and his discussion of video games. I know that Roger Travis, who does the Living Epic website, writes for them as well and does things about, let's see, I'll try to find one that he recently wrote.
when he first started, he's a classicist, and so he was comparing the Halo series to classic Greek myths and showing what kinds of things have persisted in our culture, even the most pop culture type stuff, since the Greeks first told their stories. And it's a pretty interesting set of articles to read, and he's continued to do that as the years have gone on.
The Fallout 3 article is actually, it's also very interesting. When I was first playing Fallout 3, I wasn't particularly brought into the world. I didn't particularly enjoy my time spent there. And I've talked about it numerous occasions on the site. It's kind of my fault. But Trevor talks about Fallout 3's world as something completely optional almost, right? Like the learning the history of Fallout 3 is something you do kind of naturally. But you don't have to compile it in that way if you don't want to, you know? Mm. And I think approaching games, looking at them as fictional histories, but also kind of mirroring our own histories. You know, Fallout 3 is absolutely mirroring not only the, you know, the 50s and the 40s, based upon all of the sort of old iconography, the nuclear war bunker mentality that was sweeping the United States. But it's also it's also displaying what, you know, maybe what America could be one day, or what might happen in a disaster situation in the modern era. And so there's all sorts of conversation going on there between a fake history and real history. And you don't have to see that if you don't want to, you know, or you don't. That might not always be clear to the players when they're first exploring the Fallout 3 universe. And I think it's a really cool and valuable approach.
It's nice to see someone go into that optional stuff, because it's hard. I mean, you've written about this before. It's hard to get people to learn from games if they think that they're going into a, quote, educational game. Because, you know, once you call something an educational thing, it becomes boring. You know, it's just... people have that reaction, and so I think it's important to highlight that stuff where it exists, because it's easy to gloss over and just kind of subconsciously digest, I think.
That's absolutely true. And Trevor mentions in his post that in some ways Fallout 3 presents a historical simulator where you're trying to piece together the history on your own, and you deal with all sorts of problems that you encounter when studying real history that you are probably far more intimately familiar with. Like dealing with historical gaps, you know, where there's not very much documentation about that time period, or contradictory information, for example. And it's another one of those, and I love it, of course, because I've talked about Mass Effect 2 in this way numerous times, but the game is educational without being, you know, exactly directly didactic.
It's not Math Blaster, but you still can learn something from it.
Yeah. Although, hey, don't hate on Math Blaster. That's a great game.
My fractions are owed all to Math Blaster.
Well, we shouldn't talk about Play the Past too much, because I would love to get some of their writers on the show sometime and talk with them. So.
Previews. Ooh. So shall I wrap up with the last article that I wanted to highlight?
Yes.
This is from someone who's been in the video game blogging business for quite some time. Michael Abbott wrote a post in October called Riffing on the Flagpole, in which he likened 2D platformers to jazz. And it was, I'm a sucker for that type of stuff when you start talking about 2D platformers, so I couldn't pass it up. I mean, the basic thesis of the post was, platformers are our jazz, our meaning video games. They're original creations built on a foundation of well-built standards. And he talked about the relationship between things like Super Meat Boy and the original Super Mario Brothers, and how everything from Mega Man to VVVVV to Kirby all exist in the same general style, but improvise so radically on it that they become distinct from each other.
Yeah, I think that analogy works fantastically, especially when you look at a lot of indie darlings and games produced during like game jams, for example, where people don't have very much time, and so they kind of just riff, and they kind of take something that is tried and true, the 2D platformer, and play with it, and it's far more experimental than there's a lot of room for experimentation within that genre. And I don't know, I'm not particularly a music aficionado. I do like a lot of types of music, but I'm not, I don't have the vocabulary to properly explain myself. But when I listen to jazz, or when I, what I know about jazz, it's something that is very open to experimentation. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of variety, even in modern jazz, although, you know, there's some also major problems and trends with it, which, but again, even that is part of the platformer genre. You know, people are getting sick of platformers, especially indie platformers. And that might just be indicative of maybe not enough experimentation.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what direction it's going to go to. But I mean, another comparison you can make is that, you know, jazz, for Americans at least, is a unique is a unique musical form. It's something that, you know, took its form in the country rather than, you know, being imported. Well, I mean, it was imported for hundreds and hundreds of years before it was created, but, you know, by that time, everyone had been living in the country for quite some time, if you want to go back to old slave songs and things like that. But I mean, if it's so, it's a unique form of music, just as the 2D platformer is a unique form of expression. Like, there's no analog of the 2D platformer in film or books or anything. It's a completely, I mean, the closest thing is those old, you know, like Egyptian walls where there's no perspective and you see everything in two dimensions and you have to piece together the story.
Yeah.
You know, it's a strange way of telling you about a situation that really only exists in video games. So it's like its exceptionalism, I think, kind of drew me towards the post as well.
Well, how does 3D platformers fit into this analogy?
I don't know. I haven't worked that one out yet. But I mean, 3D platformers, you know, like in Mario 64, the quintessential 3D platformer, they were very careful to show you how and why the camera worked. And there was a Lakitu floating around in a cloud with a camera that they were very clear to show the player. Like, it's being shot like a TV show. Think of this like a movie. Think of this like someone is shooting it.
Yeah.
Whereas there's nothing like that in 2D platform. You just kind of have to come to grips with this world as it exists. And it's a unique thing, and there's a lot of improvisation going on. It's just something that is very unique, which, you know, like I said, which drew me to the post.
Oh, absolutely. It reminds me of a couple of posts. The first one was by Lee Alexander, and I think the second one might have been by Kirk Hamilton from Gamer Melodico, about how games are more like music than they are like film. And they made a pretty persuasive argument. I don't know how much I buy into it, but I think it's interesting to think about the way we compose song and verse, and how we play with musical genres versus how we play with, say, literary or film genres, and what might be closer to games as we have them today.
So now we need to wait till the big music critic takes Roger Ebert's place?
Yep, pretty much. Games can never be a full, wonderful album release.
Damn you, John Williams. All right, well, we should wrap that up there. If any of you want to write in with your thoughts, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
Also, if we missed any particularly interesting stories that you absolutely love from 2010, feel free to chime in the comment section to this podcast, as well as any of our posts. We update the site Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday evenings, so come on down and bring your friends. Again, that's experiencepoints.net.
Looking forward to hearing what you all think, and any new websites that we can take a look at. Maybe your own website.
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, we certainly passed some people out, so.
Cool. Well, until then, take it easy.
Bye-bye. Every time we disagree, there's a place to go to.